Hello, John.
Hello, George.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It is, it's very good to be back on Pseudoscience Saturday.
Pseudoscience Sunday, actually. They're going to do that on Sunday. And we're going to do real science on Saturday.
Are they actually going to have Pseudoscience Sunday?
Superstition Sunday.
Superstition Sunday.
See, just kidding.
You know, here's the problem. I've been thinking about this, and of course, the issue of separating science from pseudoscience is a has been a tremendous philosophical, academic issue, and also a practical issue in for people like us, for science journalists and scientists mm-hmm. themselves, forever. And the problem is, who's the final authority? I mean, you get complete bullshit published in peer-reviewed journals all the time, in Nature and Science and places like that, and you get the smartest scientists in the world espousing all kinds of wacky beliefs. So, you know, I think...
Well, yeah, but surely you'd agree that you can draw a pretty clear line around, say, astrology or reflexology.
I wanted to talk about astrology
Carillion
today, George.
Photography.
Well, I don't know. I think... Yeah, there are certain things that I think are beyond the pale, although, of course, not for believers in those. But what complicates matters is that so much of what is considered conventional science published in Scientific American and places like that is, I think, also beyond the pale and shouldn't be considered as legitimate science.
You're not going to compare superstring theory to astrology, are you?
I don't think... The analogy is completely absurd. It's somewhat it's different. I think astrology on its face is just flat out wrong. I think we can conclude that by now. Where superstring theory, the problem that I've always had with it is the lack of testability even in principle, and that's even more dramatic when it comes to multi-universe theories.
Yeah, but it's proceeding according to a scientific protocol, though, compared to, you know, like New Age pseudoscience.
Oh, I don't know. I think alchemy was proceeding according to a scientific protocol.
Well, at the time, yeah, and then it really, you know, chemistry emerged from alchemy as, you know, as they learned more and the experimental method became more established and, you know, the accepted forms of reasoning. But, I mean, it's true, obviously, that superstring theory hasn't been subject to test, but at least it does make predictions, and people, you know, spend, you know, a lot of time mathematically computing what kind of things they're likely to see if certain aspects of string theory are true, and these things can be looked for, you know, if and when they ever get the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, going up at full blast. So
it's a totally lost cause. I was going to propose a solution.
The LHC or superstring theory?
Both. I was going to produce...
How can you say that?
I just want to suggest a solution to this whole impasse and some of these big debates we get over at Blogging Heads TV about things that are beyond the pale or not beyond the pale and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, we need somebody to take on the responsibility of being the final arbiter and the final authority. And
you mean for Blogging Heads or for the universe?
I mean for the universe. And
okay, that's God, John.
Well, no, because I think God probably gets these things wrong as well. I would be willing to take on that responsibility, George, because frankly, I don't see anybody who can really distinguish between what's real and what's bullshit. I mean, you're pretty good.
Yeah, but wait, so you're saying that you can't? You're saying that no one else can except you? And
yeah.
Honestly, wow, this is scary, John.
Okay.
Wow, but it should be an elected position, don't you think?
No, because, you know, obviously a lot of people think that I'm a crank. And,
well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean...
So, no, it can't be an elected position because obviously I wouldn't have a prayer.
Okay. No. Yeah, but I'm just not sure, you know, if you're going to have a whole lot of authority.
Yeah,
you know,
I know.
Like, people are not going to grant you the authority to decide that, probably. But
the point I wanted to make is there is no authority. We just all kind of have to figure things out. It is, in some sense, science is, in some sense, a democratic process, although in other senses it's not democratic at all. It's a very elitist institution, and if it all came down to voting, then creationism would supersede evolutionary theories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So obviously, I mean, there was this ridiculous thing recently in the news where the United States Chamber of Commerce was challenging, I guess, the Energy Department. Anyway, they were challenging believers, quote unquote, in human caused global warming to a debate. You know, as if you can decide scientific matters by rhetoric and debate instead of by experiment and careful reasoning. And what really was funny is the press release that was issued by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce itself said this would be great. It would be just like the famous Scopes trial. Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's true, except, you know, there's kind of two interesting things there. One is the Scopes trial was about, you know, creationism versus evolution. So, you know, are they comparing their position to creationism? Because they're taking on the, you know, the so-called dominant scientific view of global warming. And then, of course, there's the fact that, you know, John Scopes lost the trial.
Right. Yeah.
Evolution was, you know, and then later. So, you know, you just can't decide these things by rhetoric, just as if you can't decide them in a court of law. It's just a different kind of reasoning.
Yeah, but here's
much tighter, tighter kind of reasoning.
We do
live. The final arbitrator, John, is nature.
Yeah, but here's the thing, George. We do live in a democracy, and those ignorant, unwashed masses can and do determine.
Oh, they're mostly very clean, I think.
The future of science by, for example, pulling the plug on the superconducting super collider,
yeah,
whatever that was.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, as far as scientific funding, that's very
yeah,
true.
Yeah, oh, but, God, I mean, it has a huge impact. So some of these things are decided, and it has a tremendous impact on the future of certain fields. I mean, stem cells, we elected a president for 8 years who felt that it was his obligation to appease his Christian voters to you know, put the clamps on stem cell research. There's another
reason.
Yeah,
but it's not like the research stopped in its tracks. I mean, you know, the government's obviously a hugely important source of funding for science, but, you know, no one could stop the science itself.
Right. Well,
but,
that's...
Yeah, no, I mean, I certainly agree with your point that, you know, there's a political... You know, science works within this political framework, but, you know, inside that framework, it's, you know, it's not politics and popularity that decide whether a theory is accepted or not.
Jesus, I don't know. You know, Paul Feyerabend said that his reading of Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolution was that science is very similar to the operation of the mob, of criminal enterprises.
Yeah, but Paul Feyerabend, you know, I mean, he was just kind of, you know, he liked to antagonize people with outrageous statements.
You know, Feyerabend also had this wonderful line. He said that, let me see if I can get this right, because I didn't write it down. Astrology certainly doesn't hold up well compared to celestial mechanics, but it does hold up well compared to economics. He said it in a more clever way than that, but it was that was essentially his. He was sort of trying to make the point that people who think that they can decree what counts as real science and what doesn't often defend certain sciences that really, when measured against the really hard sciences like nuclear physics or molecular biology, are pretty flimsy.
Well, yeah, certainly some sciences are better at prediction than others, but, you know, again, you know, if you compare economics, no matter how unreliable the predictions are, it's still working within the scientific framework, as opposed to astrology or intelligent design, which are very similar in that they're positing the existence of supernatural forces and saying that you can just say, well, you know, stuff happens because, you know, some spiritual force did it. So that's very different. I mean, one's saying, no one's bringing supernatural forces into economics. It's just it probably always will be a very imperfect kind of science or discipline. Maybe it's not even a science yet. I mean, I take your point, and I'm sounding here like, hardcore positivist, and actually, as you know, I'm really fascinated by this whole notion of the relative truth of different knowledge and the extent to which science can be compared to, like, mining pre-existing veins of ore or comparing it to improvisational jazz. That's a line that I used in long ago in my book Fire in the Mind, and the extent to which our own brains impose patterns on reality.
George, you brought up astrology several times, so clearly you wanted to get into astrology here on Pseudoscience Saturday.
No. We've got a we were going to talk about science today. Remember?
I just have to say.
Okay.
I because of this whole brouhaha about the two people, the young Earth creationist and the intelligent design person who were on Blogging Heads, and Sean Carroll and Carl Zimmer's decision not to participate in this forum anymore. I have been sort of super sensitive to science versus pseudoscience, and as you know, I am just this semester teaching a course on the history of science and technology, and I'm reading this wonderful textbook written by these two friends of mine at Stevens, Jim McClellan and Harold Dorn, and I'm just in the section of the book that deals with what are called the pristine civilizations. These are the first big city-states that emerged about 6,000 years ago. The first one was Mesopotamia. These are big agricultural societies, right. Most of them in river valleys and so forth. And what's remarkable about that, and so it was Mesopotamia, it was Egypt in the Nile Valley. There was a civilization around the Yellow River in China, one around the Indus River in India, and then Central America and South America in modern-day Peru. And what's really fascinating, I guess I hadn't realized it before going over this material in the book, every single one of these civilizations independently invented something very similar to what we now call astrology.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, there were very practical reasons for close observation of the moon and even the motion of planets for tracking the movement of how the sun rises and sets and that how that changes through the course of a year, because it gave you a timekeeping mechanism and allowed you to do agricultural planning and other functions. But
that's astronomy, though. That's not astrology.
That's astronomy, but in every one of these cases, there was a dimension of this in which these celestial motions were thought to portend changes in human affairs. And it's just fascinating to me So there's some suggestion that the very first astrology started in Mesopotamia and did seep out and influence some of the other civilizations in Eurasia, but it was invented completely independently in the New World.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe there's a genetic explanation for that. It's just, I'm not trying to obviously claim that there's some validity to astrology because of this. It raises the same set of questions that the simultaneous origin, almost universal origin of religion in all cultures.
At least in the first case, there seems to be clearly be a wired-in drive in the human brain to try to find or impose some kind of order in reality, and there's obviously very high survival, survival reasons for that, very strong survival reasons.
Right. Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, so you can see that as the beginnings of modern science, trying to discern patterns that help you predict events and control events to a certain extent. So
and then at some point, astronomy kind of takes off from what was originally astrology, and yet you know, astrology never goes away. It just keeps on century by century, and people who have no real interest in science or understanding or trying to understand how things really work, you know, then latch on to astrology and use it as kind of some kind of mental ointment.
Right.
To salve themselves. Yeah.
Nice phrase. Jesus, pearls before swine here on Blindness, George.
No,
Jesus.
No, it's But anyway, I wish I could take your class.
Oh, it's the textbook that makes it, but believe me, I feel free to digress from that.
Oh, I'm sure the teacher does too, but I'll get the text.
It is fun just to see, though, how humans emerged from the murk, and there are all these amazing cases of I guess what you'd call convergent cultural evolution, that you have these societies that are separated by enormous distances that have similar patterns of innovation, particularly in agriculture. All the pristine civilizations are what are called hydraulic civilizations. I hadn't heard that term before, but apparently something called the hydraulic hypothesis that says that the great organizing principle of all these early pristine civilizations was irrigation systems that were very extensive, required large organized labor pools, very precise planning. That led to a great incentive for record keeping, for measurements, for writing, and all those things that led to what we now see as modern culture and science, mathematics, and all the rest that makes us so enlightened.
Yeah, you can see. I mean, there's anthropologists who also trace religion, or at least this is one of the influences to, you know, the need for organization and cooperation for these big hydraulic projects.
Yeah, and I guess that, I mean, another extraordinary feature of these civilizations is the emergence of individuals with extraordinary power who were seen as
divine. They convince everyone else that you know, they can, you know, consort with the rain gods, for example, and control, you know, the rains, and then the rains come at the same time every year, and they attribute it to this individual instead of to you know patterns in nature, and then this person gains a lot of power. And you know, one of the theories behind the disappearance of the Anasazi here in the Southwest centuries ago is that the there was a change in the weather pattern, so the rain like usually here we get you know, big rains in the late summer, and then we get, you know, winter precipitation, and there was a scrambling of the pattern of rainfall according to some readings of tree ring data, and that the people then lost the faith in the magic of the leaders to bring rain at the right time. So, you know, and then they maybe had some kind of big social upheaval, or were attracted by some new evangelical religion from another, you know, like coming up from the Mexico or something like that. It's just fascinating stuff, you know, all very, very speculative.
Well, so that would suggest that there's something about, so it's not that if you have a given population of people in a certain area, that this type of social organization is inevitable. It's just that you might have a wide diversity of social organizations, but the ones that persist and consolidate power are the ones that are very hierarchical in these early stages of human evolution.
Yeah, early on that's probably going to be, I mean, yeah, you can see how that would be more stable in the short run anyway.
And they just wipe out the other one. So there might have been very, you know, the equivalent of, I don't know, a Scandinavian democracy back in 4000 BC and in Mesopotamia, but it was just wiped out by Babylon or Uruk and places like that.
But the more
like
you get public education too, right, that you're, the more you're going to get skeptical skeptical subjects that will...
That's right. And back then, the first writing systems were so extraordinarily complex that it was a very tiny minority of people who were all basically subservient to the pharaohs and kings. Had that capability.
Yeah, and even the real experts, you know, aren't going to be able to do very, very much with Roman numerals.
That's right.
You know, long division with Roman numerals. Wow.
So, okay, so
yeah,
we're gonna,
so, yeah, fascinating stuff.
We're
going to
do real science today, though, right?
Yeah, so what do you have in mind?
Solar energy, George. I read a fantastic article
recently. Oh, right. Yeah, I have
recently.
An article in this month's National Geographic. It's called
Plugging
Into the Sun.
I would just like to read from the lead, and then you can tell us about
it.
Because this is, for all any Blogging Heads viewers who are interested in science writing, forget about making money, but you can produce works of beauty in this field. Just find another source of income before you get into it. But here's the lead. Early on a clear November morning in the Mojave Desert, the sun is barely touching the peaks of the McCullough Range with a cool pink glow. Behind them, a full moon is sinking over the gigawatt glare of Las Vegas. Nevada Solar One is sleeping, but the day's work is about to begin. It is hard to imagine that a power plant could be so beautiful. 250 acres of gently curved mirrors lined up in long troughs like canals of light. Parked facing the ground overnight, they are starting to awaken. More than 182,000 of them, and follow the sun. Great lead, George.
Hey, thanks, John. Wow, it's really nice hearing one's own words read.
Thank you.
I work really, really hard on that lead. And,
well, good. I'm glad. I hope it's not effortless.
Yeah. Oh, God, no. I must have read and wrote, you know, changed and gone over those sentences. I don't know how many hundreds of times. And then of course, you know, it's just the first part of a 4,000-word article. So it was a huge amount of work, but it was very fun.
Well,
I got to go all over the place and Spain and Germany and see what they're doing with solar compared to the United States. And
well, so how did you come out? Well, first of all, explain, since we want to give people hard science this time. Hard science, meaning applied science in this case. But
okay, yeah, let's get real down to real nuts and bolts.
So the two main methods of solar energy are?
Yeah, there's solar thermal and photovoltaic. So, you know, with solar thermal, you're basically just using the sun to heat water and make steam and drive a turbine, which is exactly the same thing we do with coal or with uranium fission. So, and, you know, this isn't something you generally do in your own home. So it's like there are these huge plants like Nevada Solar One outside of Las Vegas where they have, you know, acres and acres of these long rows of parabolic-shaped mirrors, and these focus the sunlight onto circulating oil, and they heat this up to, you know, make steam and drive turbines. So it's kind of amazing. You know, I was standing out there in this field with the engineer who runs the plant, and the sun's just starting to come up, and then already you can look out over at the generating plant, and there's steam coming out of the stacks on top, and you just realize the huge amount of energy that's being, you know, just very quietly produced in this field of mirrors. And the second kind is more, you could also have big installations, but it's more amenable to, you know, putting it in individual locations, and that's, you know, the photovoltaic panels that use Einstein's photoelectric effect. So the sunlight, the photons of the sunlight knock electrons off atoms and then makes an electrical current. So
now with
kind of two different, completely different technologies.
With the photovoltaic, I think you say in some place in your article, and I've read elsewhere as well, that they're headed toward the point where you can actually create photovoltaic paint. Is that right? And you can actually
They're working on like liquid PV, liquid photovoltaic, where you could actually paint your roof with this stuff, and it would, you know, it'd be fairly low efficiency, but it would be really cheap, and you know, and that's the big thing, is getting it cheap enough that, you know, solar is ubiquitous, and because there's just some amazing statistic that this guy at this German research center that I talked to said. Ike Weber, the director of the Fraunhofer Institute of Solar Energy Systems in Freiburg. He pointed out that, or I don't know if he did the calculation, someone did, the total power needs of humans on Earth is approximately 16 terawatts right now, or 16 trillion watts. Mm-hmm. And by 2020, it's expected to grow to 20 terawatts. But the total amount of energy from the sun hitting the solid part of the Earth is 120,000 terawatts.
Wow.
So it's essentially limitless. You know, the trick is figuring out a way to harness it, and you know, and then also considering the current state of the world, it's got to compete with coal and nuclear and other sources in order to become dominant.
Did you come away after doing this article favoring one technology over the other? Thermal versus
thermal? Yeah, it really depends on where you are, because in the Southwest, where you get a lot of sun and fewer cloudy days, it makes sense to me to have these big plants like Nevada Solar One, and that one's particularly seems sensible because it's right next to Las Vegas, you know, energy hog of the world. And
yeah.
Part of the fun of this article was going from Nevada Solar One solar plant into Las Vegas and being reminded what the Las Vegas Strip looks like at night.
Right.
But, so that makes sense there, but if you're going to, in the east, you know, you're not going to have enough sunlight to, you know, reliable sunlight to probably do that, but then photovoltaic might make more sense, because in Germany, that's what they're really relying on. So even though Germany is this very gloomy, cloudy place much of the year, they have the largest amount per capita of installed photovoltaic because of the government subsidies. So yeah, I came away with this whole thing feeling pretty optimistic that, you know, if the government can really get behind this and do like during the Great Depression, you know, with the Tennessee Valley Authority and Hoover Dam, where, you know, we just really jump-started this whole new economy, or with rural electrification. All these things that are too expensive for private industry to really do, and you need to have the government kind of to come in and push them over the hump and then let it go.
Well, I'm hoping. I just attended the convocation for Stevens, the welcoming ceremony for new freshmen on Wednesday, and mm-hmm. you know, normally these ceremonies are pretty boring, and you get this kind of boilerplate rhetoric. But I was very encouraged. The president of Stevens, this guy named Hal Ravichet, was urging these freshmen to be the inventors of a new generation of solar energy technologies that could solve all our problems. And you know, that's
great. I mean, it's interesting too, because there's so many interesting technological accidents. Like this guy Weber, the German director of this research institute, was he came from the Silicon Valley semiconductor industry, mm-hmm. and he was talking about what it's like for someone who's like familiar with an Intel plant to go into a plant that's making photovoltaics, and the photovoltaic plant is just like incredibly primitive. You know, instead of having all these roboticized operations and things, you have people, you know, walking around carrying big stacks of silicon wafers and things. This at least is how he described it, and his point was that there was this juncture kind of back in the 80s when computer technology was perceived as being the place to go if you were a really smart young semiconductor engineer. So everyone went to Silicon Valley, and we get Moore's Law, where, you know, computer chips double in power essentially every, you know, 6 months to a year, and then solar kind of languished. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, certainly some good people went into it, but they didn't have that critical mass of talent. So it makes you wonder what could have happened if it had gotten as much attention as computer chips.
God, it almost makes me want oil prices to spike again and gasoline.
I know.
To
me
back
too.
To
I mean, hate to say that in some ways, but
I mean,
it was interesting. While I was, working on the article, I started doing the research. You know, I went up to Golden, Colorado, where they have this national renewable energy lab, government. Department of Energy lab, and everyone was kind of bummed out at first because you know, the economy and mm-hmm. you know, all this promise that solar had been showing seemed to be evaporating because of the banking crisis.
Right.
You know, the money wasn't available for investment. But then, you know, Obama got elected and then, you know, actually mentioned solar energy, you know, in his inaugural speech and alternative energy. And that, you know, that's really what got me thinking about the comparisons to the Great Depression and Roosevelt. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm still reading that that multi-volume History of the New Deal. And then I went out to Hoover Dam and I just, you know, felt, you know, this kind of sense of inspiration about, you know, what we can really do when we're faced with trouble. And maybe this is, you know, just the kind of time when the, you know, the economy is struggling that we can really make these hard decisions. So,
you know,
so I came out of this all being unusually optimistic.
Well, that's good. God, we need to, and that is not always true. You're not intrinsically optimistic. So that
not about a lot
something.
Of things.
You know, this just sort of a little digression. I was up in Nantucket with my kids and my brother's family was also there. He came over from England, and so of course we were talking about the debate over healthcare in this country. And he and his wife were talking about the National Health Service in England. My brother's he is an investment banker. He can afford any healthcare he wants. His company provides provides private health insurance, but they always use the National Health Service because he says there's no paperwork, it's absolutely free, contrary to what all the dumbass Fox Republicans say in this country. There's virtually no wait. The wait is much less for most service than it is in this country. So I said, how did that happen? I really had no idea how the National Health Service was created. What he said was that it was put together during World War II, so it was an emergency state. They just really needed to have they actually nationalized many aspects of the economy during World War II, and they created the National Health Service, and that worked so well that it just remained permanent. So we haven't until recently had the equivalent of that we haven't at all. But closest we've come is right now in this economic crisis, and even now it's still extraordinarily difficult to get any consensus, of course. But let me just go back. I just want to go back to solar energy.
But before you do, I was going to mention, wasn't that hilarious when Investors Daily editorial saying that, think of poor Stephen Hawking. If he had to contend with the British Health Service, you know, he'd be dead now.
Yeah, right.
Apparently, I had no idea that Hawking was British.
Right.
And as it turns out, is a big fan of the National Health Service.
Ah, that's great. I just can't believe.
That was just great.
I'd like to be an optimist. I mean, I believe in human rationality and all that. But God, there's sometimes when I despair at the level, the depths of stupidity of the American people. But anyway, going back to solar energy, I had this little debate with Ray Kurzweil. He's the leader of the cult of the singularity, which says we're all going to turn into robots. And he's, you know, so he's tracking all these exponential trends in technology, and he says that the energy produced by solar sources has been doubling every 2 years for, I forget what the time period is, let's say a decade, and that at that rate, within 20 years, we'll have 1,000 times more solar power, and that basically will be enough to serve all our energy needs, which you'd said are, you know, like 20 terawatts. I just wonder if you see, if this kind of prediction came up in any of your interviews, or if you find it remotely plausible.
Worldwide doubling every year. I mean, that would take a huge effort, because right now, even in Germany, where leading the drive for photovoltaic, it's still just a tiny, tiny percentage of less than a percent, I think. I'd have to look it up, but just vanishingly small compared with what's being produced by other sources. And the people in the United States, the more conservative researchers, seem to be thinking, you know, the time could come when maybe 10 to 20% of the United States peak energy demands, you know, like when you're, you know, when it's like 5 o'clock in Los Angeles and your air conditioners are going, and you know, which is, you know, significant. But
yeah.
But the real optimists are thinking more like, wow, this could do everything. And and I think it could. I think, you know, whether the political will is there to do it is another question. And yeah, and of course, solar, like any form of energy, is, you know, subject to the second law of thermodynamics. So if you're creating order and organizing energy, you know, you're going to create disorder
right.
and entropy in equal proportion. So it has its environmental downsides as well. But of course, you have to compare them to the environmental downsides of everything else.
Well, that was something that I found really interesting. I guess I hadn't realized that environmentalists also, or at least some certain environmentalists also.
Oh yeah, they're already jumping on the anti-solar bandwagon.
Yeah, how? Why? I mean,
well, it's what they're objecting to is. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that most environmentalists really like the idea of photovoltaic and individual, you know, kind of this small is beautiful sort of, everyone has their own solar panels, and we say goodbye to the big energy corporations. But then there's these places like Las Vegas, Nevada, with Nevada Solar One, which I started to think of it as big solar, because this is, you know, these are big corporations, you know, investing huge amounts of money to put in these solar installations, and they're covering, you know, acres and acres of fragile desert. So So that's where, you know, that's what bothers a lot of environmentalists. And
I don't know. It seems to me that the environmentalists have, you know, they're going to have a serious public relations problem if they oppose even these renewable energy sources.
I know. I think so too. But
I mean, I was just up in Nantucket, and there's a you probably know there's a big debate up there over wind farms, over these.
Oh right,
you know,
yeah.
These big,
yeah, it would be really annoying to live next to a wind farm.
Well, it does make that. I remember being in Livermore. God, this must have been 20 years ago, and they have a huge wind farm outside Livermore, California, near Livermore base, and there was this sort of low frequency vibration that I felt going through my body that was coming from these giant propellers.
Yeah.
I assume that those are becoming, that sort of problem is being...
Yeah, I think they're a lot quieter than they used to.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of windmill plants in Germany, and you know, I mean, you can certainly hear them, but I stood underneath one of them that was kind of part of this wind and solar complex in this little town in western Germany called Moorbach, and it was kind of swooping around overhead, and you know, it sounded like sort of like a helicopter, but slightly lower pitched.
Wow,
these
that's pretty
are so
that's
big.
Pretty loud.
So big, but you know, that was right standing underneath it.
Yeah.
So and this was, you know, away from the town, but yeah, you know, another issue is the power lines, because if they end up really going to centralize big solar, and you have all these huge solar plants in the Southwest, if they're going to use that to serve more than just the Southwest, it's going to mean putting in, you know, they're already talking about putting in all these new huge high-voltage power lines across the Southwest through the deserts to transport the power. So, you know, again, that's another reason that the environmentalists are pushing the idea of decentralized power, where everyone kind of grows their own. And
honestly, that does make sense. It sounds as though that you're going to need a mix of these things. You know, there's a technology I've been meaning to talk about on Blogging Heads for a couple of years now, and I don't have my little info sheet in front of me, but there is such a thing as microwave, I think it is, power transmission.
Yeah.
In other words, wireless power transmission. I think it's a pretty crude technology, so forth. But,
that's what Tesla was trying to perfect, you know, back in his day.
Yeah.
Nikola Tesla.
Right. But obviously.
Boy, wouldn't that be great, though?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just, you know, just all these wires we have all over the place. It's so weird when you look out the window and see these poles trailing wires for miles and miles, and then you have wires in your house and, you know, six different shaped power cubes,
right?
You know, hanging out of the wall. It's such a crude thing.
Well, it's diminishing with, I mean, obviously wireless technology is improving. But, you know, another point I wanted to make about...
It's different. Yeah, except with wireless sending information, you know, like patterned low amounts of energy is a lot easier than sending huge amounts of energy, whether it's patterned or not. So.
Yeah, and that giant microwave beams for transmitting power would actually be quite dangerous. So you'd have to make sure that airplanes, for example, didn't fly through them or, you know, they would be... all their electronics would be scrambled, or maybe they'd even, you know.
Yeah, I would think that would be a problem.
Yeah.
You know, I just haven't looked into it, but I think that's a ways off.
But, so, well, as long as we're on solar, I had, just one more point I wanted to make about the environmental opposition to wind and solar. I mean, what a lot of people are talking, including traditional greenies, like Stuart Brand are talking about lately, is the need for a resurgence of nuclear power in this country, and
right.
I don't want to see that because I live near a nuclear power plant, and you know, I recognize that the record is actually quite good, but I just think it's just such a that the nuclear waste problem hasn't been solved yet, and doesn't seem even close to being solved. There are security issues with nuclear power. I really would like to see the environmentalists get behind their renewables, non-nuclear technologies, and, because otherwise, then maybe nuclear power will come back, and I don't think that will be a good thing. So
I don't know. I'm not anti-nuclear at all. I mean, especially when you compare, you know, the damage done by a coal-fired plant to the potential theoretical damage done by a nuclear plant. I mean, you know, Chernobyl obviously being the huge, horrible exception, but that was very, very crude technology.
Yeah.
But, I mean, God, what the coal plants have done to the Southwest and the Four Corners area where, you know, you used to be able to, you know, like the difference of looking at the Grand Canyon now and like 50 years ago, it's, you know, just always... You know, sometimes the haze is, you wouldn't even know it was there unless you could go back and see what it used to look like, at least the old-timers tell us. But huge amounts of coal dust, and, you know, and then the scrubbers, too, on the coal plants that, you know, that's getting more and more advanced, except, you know, you have to put something, you know, the stuff you scrub out of the smoke before it goes to the air piles up, and then you have to dispose of that.
Yeah.
That includes radionuclides.
Right.
I saw an interesting article. Someone was comparing the amount of radionuclides produced by a coal plant to a nuclear plant. You know, radionuclides that escape into the environment, and the coal plant came out much worse, as I recall.
Really?
I'll look for the article and link to it, but it's certainly an issue. But,
Well, since we were talking about the sun, I just wanted to mention, just briefly, this is a piece... I'm holding up the headline here. It's called Cosmic Katrina. It's in the BBC magazine that I write a column for, BBC Knowledge.
All right.
It's about solar flares. The Cosmic Katrina is the shitstorm that may result from a gigantic solar storm, basically at any time. Mm-hmm. And... I had thought that that big solar storms are most likely to occur at the peak of the sunspot cycle, but actually it's a much more random, inexplicable process than that, and it can happen any time. So the first really big solar flare ever recorded took place in 1859, and there was a British astronomer, Richard Carrington, who was observing the sun and saw these two brilliant patches of white light and on the surface of the sun, and it totally scrambled telegraph communications at the time. So it actually had serious consequences. If a solar storm of this magnitude happened today, it is thought that it would just completely disable modern communications, especially wireless communications, but even wire and optical
communications. Yeah, they'll pick up those huge currents by induction. And
that's right. So
yeah, and all the money, which is all just, you know, computer blips now, will be wiped out. And
yeah, so
collapse of the world economy. That's pretty scary.
Well, it seems like one of these things that, you know, one of these stories that's always in the background. If you're a science journalist, you can always sort of pull it out and write something alarming.
Every once in a while, someone kind of tunes in and you get a new story on it. And
like space debris, remember that? I mean, I think that Bill Broad of the New York Times, every 5 years, he probably had it marked on his calendar. Time to do another scary space debris story.
Yeah, yeah.
About all the junk circling the Earth, and there were these the people who are really into space debris and NASA and places like that and wanted a lot more money to study it would produce these plots of all the little pieces of garbage circling the Earth, and when you produce that on in a computer printout, it's this like huge scary dark cloud surrounding the Earth, because it's of course all completely out of scale, but you look at it and you go, holy shit, that looks really bad. You know, everything, every time they spend the shuttle up, it, you know, how does it even escape being smashed to bits by all that space debris? And then of course there's the you know, the asteroid hitting the Earth story, which
right.
You know, we can write about periodically, and so
really how global warming was for about half a century.
Right.
You know, I remember I go back. I found an old some old science books down at my mom's house down in Albuquerque a few years ago, and I was looking through one. This was stuff I was reading in high school, and there was something about the greenhouse effect and the danger of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was just kind of this perennial thing that, you know, every few years someone would worry about it, like asteroids. And then at some point, though, it reached, you know, it became a creditable threat. So maybe that'll happen with these other favorite perennials.
The ozone hole. I mean, sometimes these things, they're sort of, you know, little mildly titillating science stories that not even the writer of the story takes that seriously, and all of a sudden it's very serious, and it leads to political and scientific action and the banning of CFCs in the case of the ozone hole.
Right.
But anyway, solar storms. You heard it here
first. Yeah, I'd like to read that art. Is that on the web? Can you link to it?
I think it is. They've got a... Yeah, so it's... what's the website? Something like... If you just Google BBC Knowledge, you'll find it, and then you just have to find the issue. This is the September-October issue, so that should be online by now.
Oh, okay, great. What's your column about?
Oh, my column in this issue is about... Mm-hmm. I think it's one in which I tell people that they should question authority. Except that at the very end I say, wow, this is amazing. It's tying back into our discussion at the very beginning. I say, you can't trust anybody. You can't trust the experts. There's an inverse correlation between the amount of airtime that political experts get and the accuracy of their predictions, which is an empirical fact based on a study by a guy named Philip Tetlock at Berkeley, so I mentioned that. I've talked about this before. I also talk about this experiment in which rats outperformed Yale students in guessing where food is in a maze. And so the point was that intelligence and knowledge actually can make you can have adverse effects in terms of your ability to navigate through the complexities of life. And I said, really, there are no ultimate authorities except for me. That was my punchline.
When ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise.
Who said that?
I can't remember. Well, let's see, I'll Google it.
Hey,
Yeah, so...
What else? So, you sent me, if we want to talk more about a little more pseudoscience. Actually, this is real science.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You sent me a
clip. Pseudoscience, you said.
Well, this is sort of real and pseudoscience, which is the best kind. You sent me a clip about the debate over the ayahuasca cult temple.
Oh, yeah, here in Santa Fe. Yeah, why don't you say first what this cult is and
well,
all about Seagram and things.
Yeah, this is something actually I've been tracking for years. So ayahuasca is this, it's a tea made from two plants that are found in Amazonia, in the north part of South America, and it's been used by Indians in that region as a hallucinogenic brew for ceremonies or just for getting stoned for a very long time. There's a famous Harvard botanist named Richard Schultes who discovered ayahuasca. I think it was in the 1930s. He was trekking through the forest in search of new plants, and he found these tribes that were drinking this stuff. He took it himself. And apparently didn't really have a dramatic effect on him, but I think he was friends with or acquainted with the beat poet William Burroughs.
Oh, sure.
And Naked Lunch, all that stuff. A famous junkie, took every drug known to man, and he took ayahuasca. By the way, ayahuasca, that's an Indian word that stands for vine of the dead, because you often have very dark hallucinations on this stuff and think you're communing with evil spirits or ghosts.
Yeah, you tried this, right?
Yes, I tried it.
I thought so, yeah. You know, this appears in Umberto Eco's book, Foucault's Pendulum.
Ayahuasca does?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a that's one of the sub-threads in this plot.
It's a fascinating stuff because there are two plants. One of them has a psychedelic drug called dimethyltryptamine in it that normally is rendered inert by an enzyme in our stomachs. But if you combine it with this other plant, that plant has a chemical that suppresses this enzyme in our stomach, and the DMT becomes active, and you get super fucked up. You have the equivalent of an 8-hour. The way I think of it is equivalent of an 8-hour LSD trip compressed into about 2 hours. If you inject it, it's about 20 minutes or a half hour.
Injected?
Normally the only way that pure DMT can affect you is if you inject it. If you just eat it, it doesn't work because it's rendered
inactive. That enzyme breaks it down, but you have this other plant, and then so.
So there's this question of how did the Indians even figure out that this stuff worked in this way? Another fascinating aspect of ayahuasca is that DMT, this chemical, dimethyltryptamine, has been found. It occurs naturally in the human brain.
It's
thought to possibly be a neurotransmitter. Its structure is actually very similar to serotonin.
Really?
Dopamine, and
so
some
that's
of the
another
other
thing. I mean, that's how most of these things work, though, right? I mean, they mimic or they're mistaken by the brain for another neurotransmitter.
Yes. So there's this another New Mexico. Just before I get to the wacky cult, another New Mexico connection here is that in the early 90s, there was a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico named Rick Strassman who somehow got government permission to administer DMT injections to human subjects. One of his interests was to explore whether endogenous DMT might play a role in psychosis or religious visions and so forth.
Yeah.
That was one of his...
Yeah, plus he got to just fool around with this cool drug.
Yes.
That's the main appeal, but...
So he injected it into these people, and some of them did have wonderful mystical experiences, but a significant number of them had encounters with what some of them described as as monstrous insectoid aliens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That did nasty things to them.
I think we talked about this once. So it's not this real bliss out kind of drug.
It can be, but it can be really scary.
Because, the reason this is in the news is, here in Santa Fe, this ayahuasca cult wants to build a church in this really kind of very nice semi-rural residential area, a little southeast of town called Arroyo Hondo. And I guess that's where this guy, Seagram? The Canadian Seagram fortune, right?
Bronfman. His name is Bronfman, right. But they own Seagrams.
Yeah, right, Bronfman. Okay, that's why I was thinking Seagram. The Bronfmans own Seagrams, and so that's where his money comes from. And then he got, this Supreme Court ruling, right?
Yes.
Allowing him and his followers to use this drug under freedom of religion.
That's right. It's an extraordinary case. It's received very little attention. This is the first case of non-Native Americans being allowed to ingest a very powerful controlled substance, a psychedelic drug, for religious purposes.
Yeah. So apparently they've been doing that on this guy's Bronfman's land in Arroyo Hondo, and he has a yurt there. Mm-hmm. And now he wants to go upscale and build this huge church.
Yeah.
What is it about religion? It just gets to this point where you feel like you have to build large buildings.
Right. And I think they wear ceremonial robes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I know.
Well, there's worse things you could have in your backyard, I suppose.
Yeah.
Like a wind generator.
Yeah, so...
Wind turbine.
I took this stuff about 10 years ago when I was doing research for my last book, Rational Mysticism. I have a whole chapter... Mm-hmm. On it, on this experience. I took it with a bunch of other yuppies on a farm overlooking the Pacific Ocean. This stuff makes you really sick. So we all had little barf buckets, these little stainless steel buckets that we were giving to.
We definitely talked about this before. That image is.
Right.
Yeah, this just sounds so uplifting, this religion.
I guess, I don't know, it says in this article that you sent me that these people, that they don't hallucinate, and somebody says, if you think of your consciousness as a radio, it turns the volume up, the residual, that it's not that big, you don't hallucinate. So, I hallucinated like crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Took this stuff. I had malevolent, multicolored shards of ectoplasm chasing me all over the place.
Wow. Wow. So it's kind of like the insectoid monsters.
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds pretty scary.
Well, it was really interesting. But it was a little scary too. I thought the problem is these things they seem very real. In Strassman's experiment, a lot of the people who encountered these alien beings were absolutely convinced that they were real, that they'd gone to some kind of alternate universe and communed with these somewhat malevolent beings.
Wow.
And
These are probably graduate students, right?
Yeah, graduate students are always susceptible to
these.
That'd
be a good story to find them today and see how they're doing.
You should do that for National Geographic, infiltrate the ayahuasca cult, George.
Yeah, boy, I don't know. That sounds like more up your alley.
Been there, done that.
True.
Okay, so that's enough. That's more pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to wrap up with here?
No, we were thinking maybe of talking about lightning, but maybe we should save that. I got back from my last lightning chase of the summer for this article I'm writing.
Cool. The lightning field, we want you to talk about that in detail instead of...
Yeah, so I can talk about my trip to the lightning field in southern New Mexico. I think that's good for another time.
Sounds good. Hey, we're we're going to be at exactly 1 hour and in about 40 seconds. So
yeah, right.
All right, let's wrap
it up.
Looks
like our clocks are synchronized. Well, that sounds good, John. So probably see you in a couple of weeks.
Yes, and I just want listeners to know out there that in spite of all the chaos, turmoil here at Blogging Heads, Science Saturday will go on.
It will. Here, here. So,
all right.
Onward and upward.
Yes. Okay.
Okay,
talk
John.
To you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.